Dr. Paul Shaker is a Dean of Education at SFU. He is an import for us from the United States. And it's an import that we're really delighted by. Because what Dean Shaker has done over the last few years, he's opened up the dialogue between practicing classroom teachers and the universities, and really focused on student learning. And I have thoroughly enjoyed any interaction I've had with Paul, because he has that passion and that commitment for a quality, publicly funded public education system. So without further ado, Dean Paul Shaker.
You've heard of economic refugees and political refugees. I call myself an educational refugee. I'm a permanent resident now. I've been here 2.5 years, but I'm still continually surprised by things that I find. Very few people really have a foot in both countries to the extent that I do at the moment, because I move back and forth a lot. I have a lot of ties back there. And yet, I'm very engaged here, not only in a job like a businessman might be, but with an education, which is a very public and political enterprise. But still, I can see the differences quite often. Like, for example, yesterday, I was caught in traffic near the Maryhill Bypass, sitting in my car, stopped, and wham! A lady ran into me going about 40 kilometers per hour. Snapped my head back and pushed my car forward. And so I pulled over, we got out of the car, and I was talking with her, and she was appreciating that I wasn't angry, and I was concerned because she had a little baby in the car. So then I got on the cell phone to call the Coquitlam Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and a lady answers the phone, and she says, well, is anybody injured? And I said, no, not that we know of. And she said, well, has anybody been drinking? I said, oh, no. And she said, well, then, yes. So she said, well, then you just exchange information and go your way and file your claim with ICBC. I thought, what is this, the honor system? Are you kidding me? Well, I just guess if I ever am drinking, I hope the other person's been drinking, too. I think we'll come to a quick agreement on what our story is. So I'll come back to this, because that's an example of the kind of social contract you have here. And I just can't imagine you don't take it for granted the great majority of the time, because it's like the air you breathe. And I'm sure if I stay here a few more years, I'll start to be that way too. And it'll feel good. I hope I never lose the good feeling that it should give me. And I hope that you can derive some good feelings from that, because that's really something very wonderful. And it's something that we've lost a lot of in the U.S. Well, that pertains to education, too, and I'll come back to that. But I wanted to say, in reference to the specific topics that we were talking about today, I thought a lot about reading recovery as I listened to the desire to give the best quality instruction to each student. And I have been acquainted with it for a long time, because the woman who brought it to the United States was a classmate of mine at Ohio State in the mid-70s in our doctoral programs. And I've watched throughout her whole career. Her name is Gay Pinnell. I've watched the growth of reading recovery in the U.S. to where it reaches over a million students a year. And I was on the Reading Recovery Council, and so I knew a little before I came up about the way Canada relates to it. And Canada, you know, it's not a full signatory of Kyoto in the case of reading recovery. It dabbles in it. There's some influence of it. But there's really a whole lot more structure in places like New Zealand and Australia and the United States. And I bring all this up because there is the discussion of what could we really do if we were set free to do it, if we took the lid off budgetary constraints and could serve students the way we dreamt that was possible. And you see that a lot with reading recovery. They do have full implementation of it in New Zealand. And the research continues to show what remarkable work teachers can do if they're given the situation they need to address the problem at hand. I mention all of this because people need models. They need to see things concretized. And one of the examples you can give them, one of the brilliant reforms that's occurred and is in full implementation, at least in New Zealand, and has turned around well over a million children in the United States, is reading recovery. So when people are pressing you for what we could do and they want an ideal vision, there are models like that, and we have to be ready to explain them to people. And of course, the economics of it are, you know, pay me a dollar today or pay me $5 tomorrow. And Reading Recovery has saved a lot of kids from special education and kept a lot of kids in school who wouldn't otherwise be there. Similarly with Universal Head Start, which, you know, they've never been able to get in the United States, and we thought we were getting closer to universal quality preschool in Canada, and I hope we get there, but still another example of the kind of things that we envision in a world where teachers really got to do their job to the best of their abilities and in the best way they imagine. Now, last fall, some of you may know, we brought back one of our alums, Professor Alan Luke, one of Simon Fraser's distinguished PhD alums, who has been a dean of research and education in Singapore and now is back in Australia. And he spoke with us downtown. We'll soon have it up on the web. We're still working on the video. And one of the things that came out of that talk with Alan was the fact that in Singapore, since it is a form of democracy but largely a one-party state, they're able to look at things in a long horizon and make plans over as long as 15 years to improve something like education. They're not caught in this one-and-a-half-year, two-year, three-year cycle that we tend to be caught in most of our Western democracies. And I wanted to point that out because this is one of the areas where we have to re-educate decision makers, the lay public, and others who have influence in education. We can't be turning on a dime every couple years if we're going to make the kind of reforms that we really need to see made. And again, there are models. And Singapore now is a great model for what can be done with meaningful research that really gets at accountability that's authentic and then is plugged into reforms that allow education to flourish for all children. In our own country, I had the privilege of speaking to the Manitoba Teachers Association last summer, and some of this influence I could see there. There has been a greater consensus among all the stakeholders in government as well in education for quite some time in Manitoba. Now, of course, you know better than I, it's a different world. It doesn't serve as a gateway for great immigrant populations and deal with the diversity that this province does. But nonetheless, there's examples in a place like Manitoba of some of the things that we either need to instate or reinstate in British Columbia because, for example, they have this consensus build up in a larger sphere in education so that they can work together, have longer time horizons, and eliminate some of the contentiousness and one-upsmanship and, what should we say, disruptiveness of constant changes of course and policy. So these things, if you look around the world and look around Canada, there are bits and pieces coming together of the kind of thing that we'd like to see happen here and the sorts of reforms that I heard discussed in the many meetings that I went to today. One of the themes that gets picked up a lot, and I was on Bill Good's show yesterday, and along with your keynote speaker from last night, Dr. Kim Schonert-Reichel, and one of the themes that came up there was very typical, and I think you'll hear it from well-intentioned people outside of our profession. When I went to school, there were 35 kids in a class, and they seemed to get along okay, and what's this problem about class size? What has changed was basically the question, and I think many of us saw school experiences like that. I said on the air that I was never in a class of under 40 in the parochial school that I went to for the first 8 years, and then when I was a teacher, I had over 40 in every one of my six classes down in rural Ohio. But what has changed? Well, in the population, one of the things that was mentioned today in one of the groups I was in was the rate of medical survival, how much more fortunate we are to save many children. But in a number of those cases, the children have some damage that's been done in the process of being born too early or born with some sort of problem. We have an immigrant population in a place like Vancouver that's unprecedented with most parts of the world. And certainly when I was growing up, there wasn't a single immigrant in my school. There wasn't one, okay? Now, of course, look how different it is in a place like Vancouver, you all know. There were no ESL students. I never met an ESL student K through 12 going, and I wasn't out in the boondocks somewhere. I was in an industrial town. A generation before, or two generations before, there would have been plenty, but by the time I was growing up, they were first generation and second generation kids like myself. And then finally, I never knew a kid. I never knew one kid growing up through those eight grades who was a product of a divorce or was was from a family who had experienced a divorce, not one. There was only two kids who moved in and out of my school in those first 8 years. I can remember their names right now because it was so unusual. So these are some of the things that we need to remember when we look at the challenge we face now compared to what was in existence just 30, 40 years ago, and of course life as it still is in some of the rural parts of Canada and the United States. And the goals of education have changed since those days, and largely they've changed for the better. We're really committed to universal literacy. You know, we really don't want to write off kids, and that even pertains to a good many people far away from me on the political spectrum. They may have different reasons why they don't want to write them off, but nonetheless, we don't want to give up on them. We'd like to see them have a high level of literacy and be satisfied and well-educated people and to be productive in the society and to stay out of jail and to stay out of trouble and to be able to take care of their health, all those other things that are highly correlated with a good education. And we'd like to see them go on to higher education in many cases, not only because some of us believe in the power of a liberal education, but we also know that we're headed into a knowledge era economically and we need people with a high degree of training. So that's changed in society, where when I was growing up, in today's dollars, you could make, say, $80,000 a year with no high school diploma working in the factory and a well-unionized job in a steel mill in my hometown. That's gone. All those jobs are gone. Today, we care about inclusion. In those days, we didn't. I still remember the special ed class and the isolation of those kids when I went to high school down in one room at a corner of the building. We never associated with them. They were totally walled off from the rest of the kids in the class. And people, the broad consensus of people now don't want to see us go back to that. So that's another challenge that we've taken on that's changed the nature of the so-called mainstream classroom. Integration. We didn't care about integration in the U.S. up until Brown versus Board of Education. We still struggle with it down there, but today we care about integration all over North America, and we don't want to isolate populations. We don't want to wall off kids that are from different cultures or have more trouble with learning in our conventional schools. We want to find a way to make those schools work for them. So all these things, both in the goals and in the constitution of the student body in education, have changed since those days when I was a student and some of you were a student, and I think they've changed for the better. But we have to educate large publics about this because, as I say, just was yesterday on the radio, the same old argument. I went to school with 35 kids in a class. Why can't we do it today? And the fact that people would even ask it shows that we haven't penetrated enough about how much the world has changed in these 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention as a reaction to having been here today, and I was sharing this with Dan Leitch, our young professor from Surrey. Raise your hand, Dan, who's used to be full-time with ASCD in Washington and has joined us in the educational leadership program at Surrey with Fred Renahan. I was talking this over with Dan, and he had the same feeling I did. You know, we really liked the kind of discussion that was taking place here today, and particularly because it was from such a wide array of stakeholder groups. I had no idea when I came how broad the representation would be at this conference, and that's great. Because, you know, we don't need to be talking just to each other all the time. We do need to talk to each other from time to time periodically in our own stakeholder groups to solidify our thinking and to unify. But we need to come out quite a bit, and we need to get in wider circles. And so one of my conclusions, and I think Dan feels this way too, is we'd like to see the circle widened consciously occasionally. He and I try to cover the AGMs of the stakeholder groups and get around, along with a couple other of our professors of educational leadership, to the meetings, so we're in touch with people broadly, but we still feel there's not enough integration and dialogue among all these groups. So I'm going to go back on my blue sheet. You know, what am I going to do when I go back home? I'm going to go try to work for conferences like this that occur periodically where we bring together a wider spectrum than is even here, and we deliberately bring into the room, of course, some more of my professors and the other professors of education here in the province. And I want to bring in some of the people from some of the other stakeholder groups that really don't agree with us. I think we're ready for that. I'll give you one example. Most of you probably saw the big headline and two follow-up articles in West Coast News in the Sun this week was about the conspiracy of silence. And that's Peter Cowley's phrase referring to the state of Aboriginal education. And I was asked about that by a media person yesterday, and I said, you know, I've been here 2.5 years, and the number one issue, not just in British Columbia, but all the way across Western Canada, at least to Ontario, has been Aboriginal education. Now, how could anyone say there's a conspiracy of silence about it? It's the number one issue. Well, I understand how they can say this. Well, some people say it, actually, because they're never talking with us. They're never in a room to talk with people like yourselves who are deeply connected to the realities of education in this province, and we need to get them in the room. I'm a believer that the best ideas will surface in open debate and free discussion. And one of the things that I've learned about Canadians, and you reinforce it today in the time that I've spent with you, is you dialogue about things very well. You know, you really work at listening to one another, listening to people who don't agree with you, and then responding in a courteous way to express yourself in a rational fashion. We need to get these other people in the room. We need to let the power of free expression work against their arguments. And in some cases, we'll learn something too, and we'll change our positions. So that's what's going to be on my blue sheet after having been at this conference. And finally, to return to my experience on the Maryhill Bypass, we need to be very conscious about this social contract that we're privileged to live with. And we need to make more conscious to more people concepts like the public good and the zone of protection that should exist around education. We need to restore to education a place above partisanship. We need to put education in a position where the welfare of the children, that every child counts philosophy, is present. And education is not used as a political football and blows back and forth with the wind biannually with election campaigns. We can do this. But it will take us drawing together a wider circle of people who in general care about the public good and public education and making these concepts conscious to them. So I hope to see you at future conferences, and I hope some of you are able to come to ours at the beginning of March. Look on your website. Pat assures me that the discounted rate for teachers is published there. And I hope some of your conferences and some of our conferences and the other stakeholder groups are pulled together more because we all need to get in a room together and talk. Thank you.